You know, I mean, I learned a lot also in working with Pluto and in writing the chapter. I had started off by saying, in seeking his lost Eurydice, Orpheus, the great mythic musician, was granted safe passage through the underworld. Because of his devotion to music, the underworld had very little to munch on. And useful, difficult editors sort of said, why are you telling us this? And what does it mean? So I thought, oh, what does this mean? So I really sort of dove into it, and I thought, well, what is the art of grief? Again, we live in a culture with where we have very few ceremonies that allow us to grieve fully and to understand it fully. You know, other cultures, I was reading once that for women who had lost children, there was a tradition of a lengthy period of mourning that the woman could do anything, but she was allowed to stay in her house to grieve and mourn. But after that, as an act of compassion, her community would set fire to the house, and she would either have to stay or come out into life on her own. Again, these rituals are powerful. We all know when we go into some very deep and difficult place, at some point, you know, there wants to be a ritual of going, I want to live, and no clear definition. We also know when we encounter people who have undergone devastating loss, it's difficult to address them. We don't have an underworld etiquette. And so what Pluto would like to say to all of us is, any of us who have journeyed, you know, literally in some tragic manifestation of loss of an important person in our lives, and or just through empathic identity, you know, when we see somebody else who's undergone tremendous loss, you can just go, I see your passport is stamped with the underworld, mine too, you know, good to meet you, how you doing? That we have these visas to the underworld and that sense of connectedness. And it also came home to me. I went to visit a friend's house whose child had died, and he was a wonderful artist, and his home was blooming with grief. And he said he felt that unless he expressed the art in this way, that he too would die. And I think this is part of, again, why are you telling us this about Orpheus was granted safe passage due to his artistry in the underworld? And so, you know, to become friends with what Pluto represents, we know the underworld has its own code of etiquette. You know, don't eat anything when you're there, don't litter, you know, don't loiter. And I think what that means is we can go to the underworld, to a deep place, you know, seeking loved ones, but we're not allowed to set up housekeeping there. I think that's what these rituals are about, too. We can grieve, but we cannot live there. We cannot live through the dead, but we can invite our ancestors and the dead to live through us. And this is really part of Pluto's great gift to us and why I burn the mapehu that was given to me by the Sangomas, you know, to burn on such occasions with all of us. Because it's very Pluto as well. It's the summoning of the ancestors. We invite them to live through us. We won't live through them. That's part of Pluto's underworld etiquette. And in South Africa, mapehu is part of a whole branch of what's called muti. And muti means medicine and power. These are the same words in South African Sangoma tradition. So they have many different kinds of mutis. You know, this is summon ancestor muti. So again, we can feel that anyone that we care about deeply who has died is available. We offer ourselves. When I say also that we offer ourselves as incarnational vessels, we pay homage to the love of the ancestors. Someone recently died or long ago died by saying, okay, let me live what you would have lived. You know, inviting that strength. And the mythology of now also would say that the world demands that, that we need all of our allies, all kinds of forces, and that we're not meant to be strong enough in a solo way. Saturn's sense of soloness is so that we can connect with that which is outside just our own narrow sort of skin definitions, so that we have enough duress to experiment with different parts of our psyches and really asking for help and asking for guidance from the ancestors, and that does include, you know, people who have died. What also came to mind, also this idea of the art of grief, is when I was in Cape Town, South Africa, I had a wonderful guide named Ishmael. And Ishmael said, you must go to Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela spent 27 years in prison, in exile, because you will feel what those political prisoners had to develop. They had to become spiritual magicians in order to survive. So I went out there, and it's like Alcatraz, you can go as a tourist thing now, and you're taken around by a political prisoner who showed us the bush or the tree under which Nelson Mandela had hid the completed manuscript of his book, and it was then discovered and destroyed. And for his abuse of his writing privileges, he was denied pen, paper, and books for the next 2 years. Whereupon, when he got back his privileges, he secretly rewrote the entire book, and it was successfully smuggled out. He then later also said that it was the writing of the book that kept him alive in the underworld. So we know, again, the power of art. And not only that, but Pluto reminds us that, along with Saturn, that most of art is invisible. And for all of us who want to become also totemic artists and to bring back these old forms of imbuing the material world with intention as it likes to be imbued, you know, and the land, you know, again, Carl Jung wrote to a friend of his and said, you know, it's wonderful that you bought land and that you're making these stone circles, because the earth spirits love nothing more than to be wedded to human ingenuity. You know, it's this wonderful dance. So in art, the way this was also expressed to me in a very Pluto way was going to a shrine room where a Tibetan Lama had made a Buddha, and I was just on the threshold, and I walked into the shrine room, and there was this irrefutable, you know, wong, 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 and stepped out, nothing. Stepped in, wong, 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 wong. You know, and somebody, a student, watched me and said, yes, Lama so-and-so really knew what he was doing when he was making that Buddha. And the idea is that, you know, most of it's invisible. You make a Buddha and you layer it with prayers and intention. Then you cover it up. Then you layer it with another layer of prayers and intention. Then it's covered up. And so on until you're just seeing 10% of that art piece. 90% of it is invisible. So Pluto also says the art of grief is important in that way, or the Plutonian art of transformation. Not only the art of grieving to get us through the underworld, but the art of grieving remorse for the world. But then creating these healing antidotes, like the Buddha. You know, and whether we are artists or not, Pluto says we are all artists of transformation. And remembering that ritual is anything that we do that we imbue with intention. We'd say the gods in the material world want to be danced with in this way. So the themes of what South Africa really gave, I think, to us, is I met many people who had every right to be incredibly bitter, who had spent years in the underworld. And many of them were bitter. But the extraordinary number was those extraordinary people who'd spent years in the underworld and had every reason to be bitter and who were not. Ishmael was saying everyone was, you know, on tenterhooks. How would Nelson Mandela emerge after 27 years in prison? And they were prepared for anything. And he said that on the day some years back, which was the first day that blacks could vote in South Africa, he said everyone in the townships thought that perhaps it was a trick and that they were all going to be shot, but they were going to go vote anyway. And the miracle of Nelson Mandela emerging loving and tolerant rather than bitter is part of Pluto's alchemical, like the chickpea, where we get cooked and the dross is cooked away. So again, cooperating with what Pluto represents is crucial. What speaks to our Pluto, the Pluto part of us is the part of us that feels that we have a mission and that that can get us through difficult things. As long as we feel there's meaning in our hardship, again, it can sustain us. So we have colleagues in history who remind us. I mean, George Bernard Shaw writes, "This is the true joy in life, the being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one, the being thoroughly worn out before you are thrown on the scrap heap, the being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy." So our mission says whatever we're doing in the world, whatever our profession, whatever we're disguised as, doctor, lawyer, astrologer, musician, says that's our cover. You know, we are really undercover agents for Pluto, for transformation in the lives of ourselves and others. The Eden by shadow theme, in a sense, well, Pluto's almost all shadow, and it's that idea of redefining power. Pluto really wants to destroy small will so that we can open up and align ourselves with larger will. So Pluto's only permittable form of prayerful magic is the proviso, the prayerful proviso, that says, whatever is best for all creatures in all realms, thy will be done. And it's the only form of magic acceptable to Pluto. We'd say lesser magic or black magic is, you know, kind of I want that boy juju, or what I call Hinayana honky Wall Street magic, you know, I want it, I get it, you know. So we'd say that's negative Pluto, you know, that's black magic really. So it's the power to transform, and the touchstone story that, again, I get most of my metaphysics from the New York Times, and the touchstone story from the science section is this wonderful story. And it's a story in which scientists were up to their usual habit of torturing monkeys, and this time they had a particular species that was very dominator-oriented, strong hierarchical structure, and they kept introducing new dominant male monkeys into the tribe. So what happened, though, was at a crucial point, half of the monkeys basically became Jamaican. They said, hey man, we're out of here. We're going to go have culture. In fact, we just noticed that all the women are already doing that, you know, and we're going to go be with them. And the remaining monkeys who continued to vie for dominance, they all died. They either killed each other or they developed autoimmune diseases and high blood pressure, heart disease, and they were dead within a year. And what this tells us is that dominance is an evolutionary dead end. it will kill us, you know, and we want to die to it. We want to offer ourselves, in a sense, to Pluto to strip us of the desire to control or be controlled. And also many of us may know about the happier monkeys, the bonobo monkeys, with which we are related as much as we are related to chimpanzees. But the work by Franz de Waal and other scholars is only now coming to light. But the bonobos are very, very different. The bonobos are basically a matriarchy, whereas chimpanzees resolve all sex and food issues with power. The bonobos resolve all issues with sex. And they, you know, it's almost, you know, everybody with everybody, pretty much, and then they all settle down to a happy, relaxed meal. So I think, you know, people who are looking for work, you know, the bonobo dating service, I think, is also, you know, a possible opportunity. Which brings us also to what I call strictly plutonic relationships. Pluto brings us to the realm of relationships also, and what is a good relationship in the modern world? What does this mean? We'd say Pluto is too powerful for private concerns, just as plutonium is too strong to cook dinner with. And that Pluto governs all taboo and intense emotions like compulsion and obsession, and the resulting cheap perfumes named after them. A note to marketers, you know, taboo and obsession are taken, but compulsion is still available. To give you a literal kind of ritualistic example of how you can work with this, is a wonderful ritualistic friend of mine was madly in love with a guy, but there were others involved, and he left and went back to original partners. And my friend was in the Plutonian underworld of obsessive depth. And being a ritualist, she knew, you know, if something's a problem, make it bigger, but in a ritualistic way. So she decided to give herself ritually a full night to completely surrender to obsessive grief. So she, you know, kind of drew her circle and lit her candle and said the following, you know, in her heart. She said, "If you, oh loved one, you know, are not meant to be with me and you don't love me as much as I love you, then nothing will happen, nothing. But if we are meant to be together and if it is good for the whole greater thing, then you will not be able to not think about me whether you are waking or sleeping." So she lit a candle, and as the candle burned down, she gave herself complete permission to, you know, read old love letters and roll around in grief and play sentimental music and just, Now, by the time the candle burned down, she said she was free. You know, she still liked the person, but there was no obsessive grief. It had burned down. Just, and she emerged from that circle, conducted her life, and her beloved showed up and said, "Whether I'm waking or sleeping, I can't not think about you." And she said, again, Pluto really requires cleanness. And she said, "Okay, you know what it's like without me. Go back once again into the other relationship and really feel what it's like without the other person. And when you're clear, let me know." And he did, and they've been, you know, pretty happily married for the last 20 years with the usual problems, but it did work out. Now, I've given this to people, too. It's powerful Pluto magic, and it's interesting if one is obsessed, like, oh, and I go, "Well, here's this thing, and it requires staying up, you know, most of the night." And they're like, "Oh, forget it, you know." You go, "Well, then you're free right now. It worked, even without you doing it. You're freed from obsession. Because if you don't want to stay up all night, you know, kind of moaning and rolling on the floor, then it's not really obsession." So it's also very interesting, too, because it's like Inanna and Dumuzi. In a sense, she did transfer the obsession. You know, Inanna came back up from the underworld and went, "Oh, Dumuzi, it's your turn to go down." The obsession was transferred in this interesting way. And Pluto says, we're allowed again to experiment with this kind of fierce magic as long as, again, it's clean, that it is always the proviso, you know, what is truly best for everyone involved. Let it happen. This is what I would like. But that is the overriding proviso. And another thing that goes along with that, with Pluto's bag of tricks that with which he wants us to become, you know, social change artists, is the theme of if somebody's really got your goat or if somebody's really problematic in the world, you know, presidents or people just in your neighborhood, says go to your room, light a candle, and imaginatively summon their invisible spiritual supervisor and have the conversation you really wish you could have. You know, I had the head of a Jesuit monastery come for an astrological reading, you know, somebody gave it to him, so he was really like, oh. But he then had a good time. He said, "Oh, I had no idea it was actually this, you know, sparkling, complex language." And I told him this. I said, "You know, here's this Pluto technique." And he said, "God, that is fabulous." He said, "You know, Jesuit monasteries are just full of the most, you know, kind of horrible intrigue. I'm going to conduct all my meetings this way." You know, and I said that I was, you know, happy to bring witchcraft back to the Christian church in any way possible. So he was happy. What Pluto wants of us right now is to laser away any obstacle to divine will. And really that sense of offering. We release our desires to control or be controlled. And again, in this context, if you just form that in your heart, it's strong. You know, we have an experimental faith that the larger order will step in also if we relinquish control. And Pluto is the part of us that values hidden work as having infinite influence. You know, there's a Chinese phrase that the right person sitting in the house thinking the right thought will be heard even 1,000 miles away. So Pluto says, again, the invisible has tremendous energetic rippling effects, that we can always be potent and effective. And one of the most powerful sense of magic that I worked with when working with delinquent kids was teaching them ritual in which they would make prayer sticks and form their prayer with it. And sometimes the prayers were movingly, poignantly simple. I want to get on better with my mom. You know, I want to not get arrested this week. I want to, whatever. I mean, they started very simply. But the kids found that it worked. I mean, they were cynical at first, but that making their prayer sticks, forming their ritual intention, these beautiful sticks, and planting them in the ground, it worked, and it gave them a non-economic model of power. Again, these planets would say, poverty is tragic, but the greater tragedy involved is not even the literal material circumstances, but the reduction of imaginative possibility that comes with it. So Pluto says, when we work alone, Pluto comes to visit to remind us that we're all public dreamers. If we work for Pluto, he or she works for us. So we're now going to do a traditional dance of flirtation, but it seems strongly Plutonic. And as they sing it, we think of the flirtatious nature of intensity and all of the inanna and obsession and compulsion and dancing with that and still maintaining sense of humor. So this is Yaba. Neptune now wants to be present for us. So we say Neptune presides over the oceanic realm of dreams, imagination, vision, and myth, inspiring in us the poetry and art to bring mythology alive. And if we remember again that part of our whole devotion now is to be midwives, to birth something positive into the world, which is the emerging mythology of conscious kinship. Neptune will also remind us that the Zulu word for sleep is butongo, which means to be at one with the star gods. It's a wonderful way of thinking that, again, in sleep, that we go off to be one with the star gods. Neptune reminds us of what we've learned already, which is the word dream also means to make music. And so how do we participate in dreaming the world into being? So the Kabbalists said, for instance, if God is everything, how does God use no material outside of God and create the world? And they said, well, by analogy, how do we humans create something using no material outside ourselves? And they said, with our imagination. And we are made in the imagination or the image of God or the divine. Not that we look like old men with beards. We are dreamed by the divine, and in fact, our dreaming and our imagining is the divine part of us that continues to participate in dreaming the world into being. So Neptune also would say very strongly to us as social change artists, you know, that holding a vision of the desirable world allows the Neptunian protoplasm of current reality to begin to morph into that template. We'd say that Neptune is the dreams that stuff is made of. And it's a wonderful quote that I found from a strange source that's very Neptunian. The quote is, "What is the future? What is the past? What are we? What is the magic fluid that surrounds us and conceals the things we most need to know? We live and die in the midst of marvels." That's from Napoleon Bonaparte. And says, even tyrants were closet mystics, you know, everywhere. And we find these themes. So Neptune would say to us, what happens when we don't have a living mythology? Again, the toxic mimic of celebrity culture, yes. But it says Neptune is also a trident. It says, what happens to a person, family, or culture when there is no living dream? It says, well, people get hooked then on Neptune's addiction to anything that numbs the pain of melancholy and alienation. It can be drugs, it can be substances, it can be disappointment, it can be romantic melancholy, any of those things. But Neptune would very much say, with great spiritual teacher Reverend Ike, you know, if we can dream it up, we can dream it down. You know, if Saturn says, you know, uh-oh, almost lost my sense of humor, Neptune says, do we live in the most lovingly ingenious, beautiful, just world now? And if not, then let's dream it into being. And time is a crucial part of what Neptune would offer us as a strategy. Because we might say, at any point, you know, do we have enough time? Do we have enough time to answer our phone calls, our mail, and save the world? And Neptune would say, well, it depends on what kind of time you're talking about. If we're talking about Saturn, visible, realistic, you know, tick, tick, tick time, the answer is no. You know, we don't have enough time to answer our phone calls, let alone save the world. But Neptune says, ah, but if we're talking about dream time, that's different. Which in Chinese fairy tales is called irrational time, you know, where you step into the magic mountain and, you know, months go by and you come back out, minutes have elapsed. You know, and it says, well, Neptune associated with dreams, vision, and water. We know that gazing at water is like dream time. You know, we know that beautiful music, you know, staring at clouds, this is dream time. And so this is a crucial theme, reverie, reflection, and reversal. The theme about time, because many of us say, well, we don't have enough time to take time out for, you know, Neptune. But let's put it this way also. Neptune would say to us, most of us know the experience of coming into the room, you know, and forgetting what we came in to get. Is there anybody here who has not had that experience? You know, anybody who's on an IV ginkgo drip or possibly? Or okay. So the Neptunian analysis would not be, you know, oh, premature dementia. It would say the Neptunian dreamer part of us that needed non-guilty space out and reverie, we didn't feed it that day. So it took space out in the midst of focused activity. So this theme of reverie, reflection, and reversal, and Neptune would say, these are important shape-shifting, dreaming, participatory, effective tools. We all pretty much know about the power of visualization, but another touchstone story that I think has infinite ramifications is a friend of mine, long estranged from her son, her grown-up son, and asked for a dream that would help her understand and or resolve this. And she did have a dream that night in which she saw an octopus wrapped around her son's heart. And she woke up going, whoa, you know, what do I think about that? And it was like, well, no time for Jungian analysis. What do I do with it? So she imagined shape-shifting into a dolphin that butted against the octopus until it let go and swam away in her imaginative reverie. And the next day, in real life, her son called and said, you know, this is silly, let's work it out. Well, the reason I love this touchstone story and invite us all to experiment with it is that it has a lot of ramifications. Not only does Pluto say power issues can be resolved in the invisible spiritual ritual domain, but Neptune says also we can undream and redream the world in our own homes, but also the implication is if we gather with other people, you know, who knows how we can set strong currents in motion. It's also crucial because it invites us then to not be passive consumers of the dream news, but active participants of the mythic news. There are styles of dreams that I like very much. There are many dream versions that are valid, of course, but this one invites the dreamer to tell the dream, but then to retell the dream as though every part of the dream is themselves. The example is, you know, I dreamed I was on such and such a street, and the dream coach would say, what's that street? And they'd say, busy street outside my house. So then you'd say, I dreamed I was in the public part of myself. Well, I like to stretch this open so that we understand a crucial gift of Neptune's, which is the whole theme of complicity. Not shame, not blame. These are such tricky subjects and concepts, but complicity. We're dreaming the world into being, and we are all kind of group complicit in how it is. You know, the writer Hawthorne says, we must not lose our sense of compassion and kinship, even with the guiltiest among us. And Neptune invites us to think of everyone as that part of our team. So when we look at the news, or we look at horrific stories in the news, a child kills its mother, a child kills another child. You know, Neptune would say, rather than go, ooh, terrible aberration, isolate, lock it up, you know, make it go away, we'd say, ah, if this were a dream, it would make complete sense. We are killing our mother. We do live in a culture which is complicitous in violence towards children. And the understanding that when pressure comes down on the collective, it erupts through the thinnest, most sensitive membranes, psychic, psychotic people, abused people, who erupt in some horrific way, but it's part of our entire dream. What I'm inviting also all of us to entertain is, you know, if something is profoundly moving to us in the news, we'd say poignancy is kinship. It's like, oh, is that sense of becoming altar builders at home and saying, well, if I read again that the Arab and Israeli parts of myself had yet to achieve peaceful accord, how would one set up an altar that would strengthen what those represent to each one of us? You know, what is the Palestinian part of ourselves? What is the Jewish part of ourselves? You know, what is the black spiritual church part of ourselves that the illiterate white southern male part of ourself was burning down? And how would we strengthen that? And again, Pluto would say, yes, we may want collective art and theater to express remorse and then transform and move into the invocative magical, but also in the privacy of our own homes, we may want to set things going and go, what would strengthen this? So that, again, that we're not passive in the face of the news, but we're active dreamers. You know, in Japanese, there's a very high form of the language in which everything is prefaced by played at. You know, I played at going to work. We're playing at listening to these words now. Even to the point of saying, I hear your father played at dying. I mean, it's this very refined form. But it reminds us also that, you know, we are all teammates, and there are people, you know, playing at bad roles. But there's a teammate sense underneath. Reading the world mythologically and symbolically makes us activists and is very powerful. And the crucial capacity to read the world symbolically is not an academic pursuit. It has everything to do with the world we invoke and create. For instance, you know, for as long as we have poetic memory, human imagination has been tied to the ocean and tied to water. So Neptune would say, what species would poison the collective water supply? And Neptune would say, a species that had forgotten its mythology of conscious kinship. Now, what happens on the east coast of America is that the great pollutant in a lot of the freshwater rivers is this bacteria, Fusaria, which comes from corporate farming. And one of the things that it does is it creates a disease in human of memory loss. So we'd say our loss of mythological memory has allowed us to commit atrocities to the collective community, which create diseases which result in physical memory loss. It reads poetically, and again, if you can begin to decode it, it then says only the loss of human imagination could have allowed us to poison the water. And only the healing of human imagination can allow us to heal the water supply that we all share, and vice versa. Only the healing of water will allow us to heal our human imagination. So Neptune calls upon us to reverse the war on nature. And a touchstone example, we all know from our own increasing kinship with plants and animals that, again, whatever we speak to will respond to us. And once in Hawaii, I was following this very beautiful sea turtle. We were swimming along, and a bunch of kind of Yahoo tourists said, hey, a sea turtle, let's go mess with it. So I summoned some mythological identity and credentials and said, I'm from the Department of Kali, and I am ordering you to not mess with that sea turtle. You know, and they said, oh, yeah, yeah, but they swam away. And then the sea turtle did this interesting thing. It swam slower, and it really did look back, I promise, to see that I was following. And it took all these turns, and it took me to this underwater canyon, which was full of corals and spires and thousands of sea turtles wafting everywhere. And the sea turtle said, you did me a favor, so I'll take you to Sea Turtle World. So we say that whatever we protect and whatever we serve will guide us. You know, and that's increasingly a strong theme now. So So we owe it to the whole team, again, to explore and to think of your life as a spiritual detective novel, you know, that everything's an important clue. If you love a particular part of land, if you love a particular, you know, kind of animal, if you love a culture, follow that, because that's part of what you have to give to the world. You know, the activist John Seed, who's involved in rescuing the rainforest, really, it's kind of destiny in a name, but he was asked, you know, how do you not feel heartbroken at the apparent, you know, hopelessness of saving the rainforests? And he said, if I thought I were just human, I would be completely heartbroken and depressed. But I think of myself as that part of the rainforest that has evolved into being human. You know, so again, whatever we love, we are its ambassador in the court of the human world. It has sent us to be its dream agent, and that's crucial. So feeding the god, Neptune says, you know, we feed the god with a daily dose of vastness, and we also feed the god in the way that we'll do right now. Yamaya is the great moon goddess of the ocean. In her aspect as the presider of the ocean, we will now have her ancient chant for us, which is that which will heal our imaginations and allow us to heal the collective water supply, both literally and metaphorically.
Sounds True presents Making the Gods Work for You, Tape 2, with Caroline W. Casey.
All cultures have trickster gods, you know, and there's a maverick within each one of us that we speak to really right now, and it's eager to go. And it also reminds us, in the Quran, there's a powerful passage in which Gabriel comes to Muhammad and says, you know, we could have had no evil at all in the world if we'd made you all alike, but God would have none of it, and insisted that each person and each creature and each species and so on be unique. And so God hands to us the greater challenge to come into accord for maximum uniqueness rather than sameness. And that's what Uranus, the trickster god, always welcomes. Uranus is a part of us that knows that the only form of communication is equal, direct, straight across. People can be wealthier, poorer, older, younger, but the only electrical form of connection is direct and straight across. So we'd say, well, a good group, a good spiritual group, a good anything group is one where the trickster, rascal, truthsayer is welcome, you know, the disruptor. And it's more than interesting that in the astrological language, Uranus, this disruptive, wild, rebellious principle, is the co-ruler of Aquarius, community. And it syncretizes in Santeria tradition, Oya, who's this goddess of sudden change, she whirls her horsetail whip and brings sudden change. She is the goddess of the marketplace and the stability of the community. So it says, well, really these trickster, radical, rebel parts were understood in pre-industrial cultures as essential to the stability of community and the psyche itself. So we want to welcome this back. Uranus is our intuitions. And it says our intuitions know the choreography dance steps. You know, how do we dance, you know, chi to chi with the universe? How are we in accord? And Uranus says anxiety is the inner gauge or meter that will go up when we go away from our intuitive instincts. So we don't want to drug our anxiety away. We go, okay, everyone thinks I should do plan A. How do I feel about it? No. How about plan B? Yuck. You know, large decisions, small decisions. You know, do I want to go out tonight? Do I want to stay home and read? So again, you know, dancing with that kind of response. And this astrological language makes fine distinctions between, say, fear and anxiety. Fear is a Saturn domain that we want to push back against fear, kind of lean against it and push back the claustrophobic walls. Anxiety, though, is our, you know, intuition warning signal saying you're not on your contacts, you're off your intuition. And we all know what it is to be on contact. You know, when Uranus, that part of us, is electrically alive, when, you know, the phone rings, you know who it is. You know, when you open the book to the right passage, when you feel hooked up, and it's that sense of connected. You know, the opposite, of course, is alienation, you know, feeling like a lone, pathetic weenie in the face of a vast, uncaring universe. And that's widely available on psychic cable, you know, all the time. But Uranus is that sense of like, oh, you know, I am part of this thing. Things are clicking. They're going just right. So Uranus says, well, we feed this part of ourselves by experimenting. Experiment. Because for Uranus, there is no category of success-failure. It's in the sincerity of the experimental attempt that one gathers juice here. You know, and so it's also like the Japanese have this phrase, you know, the nobility of failure. It's like, look at all the things that person failed at. What a fabulously alive person, you know. And it is that sense of, you know, try it. The intuitively guided thing. Again, Uranus says the intuitively guided interesting risks. It's very much also about how are we to be the soothsayer. The person who says the truth, the old word for that was the soothsayer. And it's a tough job. It's an interesting job, an increasingly important job. There's something in Sufism called the Malamazi Order of Dervishes, and it's called the Path of Blame, that you go around telling the truth and you attract a lot of flack because of that. But it's considered such a difficult job that you're allowed to resign periodically from the Malamazi Order of Blame. Uranus says you pulse in and you pulse out. We all know that Uranus, this sudden change god, is this kind of electrical surge, and then it can go away, you know, and you go, okay, and then it's back on. Uranus says we are the words with which the universe speaks to itself through the agency of synchronicity and meaningful encounter. You know, again, we are all part of one telepathic connected web. So it is about connecting, and it is about meeting things on an equal level, and often that level of equality is catalyzed in us by extremity or duress. Uranus is a disruptive god, and again, we want to make a friend. Part of that is revealed to me by a story told by a friend of mine who went camping and was being stalked by a mountain lion. And each night the mountain lion got closer, and he had to keep the fire going, and he was exhausted. So finally, at the edge of his own exhausted nerves, he built the fire, and he could see the mountain lion, and he put his sleeping bag on the edge of the cliff, and he just beamed at the mountain lion and said, okay, you know, you can come for me, but if you do, we're both going over the cliff. And the mountain lion looked at him and said, okay, you know, and went away. So we'd say, you know, there are certain times when we really have to mean it, you know, and in a sense that where you really beam straight across as an equal to one's apparent, you know, somebody playing as one's adversary and say, okay, you know, this is it, we're equal, you know, mountain lion to man, you know, and here's how it is. And again, it is often catalyzed by distress. That's what Uranus wants to bring alive in us, this way of participating equally with each other, telepathic connectedness, experimentation, intuition, being a trickster, the coyote part of all of us. Somebody recently just gave me a coyote puppy, a half-coyote puppy that's very strongly wild, so I have Stella now to join Moondog. I'm learning a lot also about the telepathy with which we speak to the wild parts of our team, because Stella is challenging, and every night at 1:30 in the morning, Stella would become completely her wild self, and she would, like, little puppy, but she's, you know, bite is pretty strong with those teeth, and would be like, bite, and then she would gather things from all over the house, rocks, menstrual pads, you know, clothing, underwear, whatever, and she would put them literally in a circle around her, and then she would animate them all. I mean, she'd bring them to life in sequence, the rock, and then the pad, and then the clothes, and whatever. So when I tried to be fierce back, like, no, Stella, you know, stop biting, it would just make her wilder. It's like, you know, a mother coyote could do that, but humans, she goes, no, you know, who are you kidding? So what I did was I go, Stella, wait, Stella, I can see that you are a great collage artist. And here's our deal. You will be getting infinite amounts of love and really great food forever. So you don't need this wild biting thing, you know. And in return, I will get you appropriate art supplies. I will get you bits of colored ribbon and cloth and so on, and you can devote your life to art. And she listened. She said, it's a good deal. You know, and she never did the bitey thing again. You know, and so at night she doesn't do the bitey, scary thing. She just makes circles of objects and animates them and does this important work. So we don't know what that means, and I don't want to be too presumptuous in case I return home to find my house trashed. And it was like, so much for that cute story. But it did work, you know, and again, Jorna says experiment, experiment, that something rides, some energetic telepathic contact rides on our words. And absolutely, again, whatever we speak to will speak back to us. We've addressed a little bit, you know, Jornus's shadow, rebel without a cause. You know, to rebel against something is to be just as much in its thrall, you know, as to conform. You know, and a quote I like to use also, too, is from Marlon Brando in The Wild One, which is, you know, Johnny, what are you rebelling against? In which he says, what do you got? What it reminds us is that all of us here, the rebel maverick part of us learns early on as a child to evade and procrastinate in order to protect its uniqueness. And Jornus would say, you know, good job, that's good. But as we get older and we want to be self-employed or we want to do things and really get stuff done, and so it requires a kind of conference call in which one says, oh, Jornus, the whole team of the community, we want to get this done, and freedom really lies on the other side of this because it's the community of us, you know, each one of us talking to our interior gods, and we really do want to get this going. So rebelling forward is part of our task also in the interior world to become social change artists in the external world. How do we disrupt something that is not authentic but still invite everyone to the ensuing festivities of truthfulness? You know, and as we become, you know, in our evolution as radicals or upstarts or change agents too, this is a tricky one. I mean, we can all attract flack, you know, or suddenly run screaming out of a feng shui lecture at the Hyatt, you know, because it's like, ah, you know, the contradictions are not being addressed. But how do we invite in Oya, as we're about to do, who will guide us to be these rascally effective change artists, to be able to say the truth, but still with a compassionate heart that invites in the person who was the boring, droning person, you know, and keeps that going. The nature of suddenness, again, when we're working with these sudden things, Jornus is about getting zapped, suddenly saying the truth that everyone was thinking. It's this electrical, again, pulse and energy. And again, from nature, we might liken it, you know, to grow shiitake mushrooms, you have to plant the spores in a log, and you have to let them go dormant for a year. And then you have to come back, and you take the log, and you have to, like, really pound the bleep out of it, like, you know, and then the mushroom spores are like, whoa, you know, and they wake up and they become mushrooms. So the analogy is, you know, very often when Oya finds us, you know, we're comfortably snoozing, you know, sort of like, oh, and then what the, you know, getting pounded. So a wake-up call literally is about getting pounded. It's like, whoa, you know, but then we produce and we bloom. You know, and Jornus also would remind us that we are in really great shape to dance with this god now, historically more than ever before. If Jornus is about maximum cultivation of uniqueness and freedom, the experiment of democracy really being about to begin if we will it to, you know, imagine that the social climate is shape-shifting in such a way that everything for which we previously felt martyred or excluded or romantically rebellious or justified in being mean to other people, you know, that part of us is about to be welcome. And this is a powerful thing. So to welcome Oya, I'll read a kind of Oya prayer. And if you want it to be true for you, then you would just say Ashe. Ashe comes from Yoruba. It means the power to make the word manifest. But if you don't, really don't say it, because everyone who's been working with this material that I've been working on for a while, they say it and they're like, whoa, you know, new job, whoa, you know, sudden change does indeed happen. Oya is a powerful force. To summon Oya, who's the goddess of sudden change, we would say in our hearts, let the winds of change blow through my life, bringing the most radically enlivening thing that could possibly happen. We are hoisting our sails. And we are willing to be parasailed into the place where we can all do the most good. Ashe. If Saturn is the part of us that spurs us on to a kind of correct attitude by saying, uh-oh, almost lost sense of humor, Jupiter is the part of us that says, are we having the most interesting fun possible? You know, and it goes, no, then let's aspire to that. So Jupiter very much would like to tell us that the world belongs to the storytellers. And an example is a story is told in my family about my Irish grandfather who inadvertently tossed a $20 gold piece into the collection plate at Mass. And after a moment of anguished indecision, he said, well, I gave it to God and to hell with it. So Jupiter would say, inadvertently or not, we are constantly giving and receiving, you know, whether we mean to. You know, through Jupiter's lens, life is viewed as a high-spirited, playful journey of generosity. From the moment we are born, we're on a caravan of infinite, unfolding opportunities for constantly expanding our horizon. And Jupiter always says, take those opportunities. So we'd also say Jupiter is the largest planet in our solar system, and it magnanimously generates more energy than it receives from the sun. So traditionally, again, before people knew this, Jupiter was always associated with generosity. And again, life's generosity. And generosity being the way in which we reciprocally dance with the world. That almost all rituals have to do with generosity. If you want wisdom, you leave a gift, an offering, you know, something to the natural world, participating in this circle of generosity. So then we learn again that Jupiter is indeed a generous planet. And Jupiter forms a miniature solar system with itself at the center of 16 moons. So by analogy, Jupiter governs all systems. Again, the symbolic association existed before the kind of factual verification, but that's kind of fun too. So it's all systems, laws, codes, philosophy, computers, storytelling, as primary ways we make meaning out of life. Jupiter's the part of us that is the universal investigator. It's the part of us that loves variety and thrives on it. You know, and it says, cast our net of curiosity widely. All traditions, different kinds of food, people, cultures, the whole thing. Haul in the net, you know, edit, crucial part, synthesize, and then put things out into the world. So it's really cast the net of curiosity, gather it in, sort the catch, and feed the village with it. So it's that part of us, again, that we want to activate. So it's also the part of us that explores things that is especially important now at this historical time period, where we're really assigned the task of a kind of syncretic reverencing of the best of all spiritual traditions and the best of all cultures. You know, on a whimsical note, I call my own style of dressing, you know, Middle Eastern, Southwestern. You know, so we're, again, gathering these different forms. And it's also, again, that we say, you know, we love this part of this spiritual teaching, but not the hierarchical structure. So it's like, keep the sacrament, toss the church. So Jupiter's very involved in that kind of prankster, joyful pranksterism. You know, so Jupiter has traditionally been associated with publishing and teaching as the culmination of kind of research, being a universal investigator. So this god's favorite form of teaching is travel, storytelling, games, ritual, and theater. And so what goes along with that is the Jupiter Ritual Starter Kit, which Jupiter and I cooked up. So basically, Jupiter says to all of us, whenever we concentrate on Jupiter, like now, Jupiter says to each one of us, I will make you a wealthy person by your own definition of what that would mean. And again, very radical, very important for us to begin to define what is a wealthy life. You know, as we know, money is not wealth, it's a part of wealth. But what is a wealthy life? You know, and then once we begin to answer that for ourselves personally, you know, time to think and cultivate our gift and give it to the world. Because part of Jupiter would always say, a wealthy life is always where you can be generous. You know, and that generosity also indeed invokes a wealthy life. It's this circle. So Jupiter says, I will make you a wealthy person by your own definition of wealth. Here's the deal, because Jupiter is, you know, governor of law and therefore litigious. So Jupiter says, here's the deal. It's a three-part deal. Jupiter has a 12-year orbital circuit. So it invites us to view our lives in 12-year cycles. So Jupiter would say to us, now, tell yourself your own story from 12 years ago to now. How you got here starting 12 years ago. And you go, where was I 12 years ago? And Jupiter says, whatever you wanted to do 12 years ago, you weren't ready. Now you're ready. And in fact, by telling the story of oneself 12 years ago, without striving for meaning, just priming the pump of associative reverie, you know, books read, heartbreaks, you know, different jobs, different things learned, travels, journeys, important conversations. It's a retroactive redemption of the last 12 years because what Jupiter will present to each one of us then is an opportunity that only we could do which is as much a sense of divine assignment as anything, which you go, oh, you know, this is somebody who's got to have these skills and know these people, and it's made for me, I can do it. So telling ourselves our own story opens the path to be able to give our gift more fully to the world and express ourselves. So Jupiter says, that's part one. Part two, Jupiter often says, Jupiter's a big planet, so Jupiter says, I will make everything bigger. So whatever you don't want made bigger in your life, toss it now. And again, Jupiter says, I don't understand words, I only understand ritual. So the Jupiter starter kit is to earth something by writing it down, to air it by just muttering it to yourself, to fire it by burning the piece of paper, and to water it by taking the ashes and throwing it in living water. And again, just with an attitude of experimental faith as something much more potent than saying, brooding, or thinking. You know, it's getting it moving. It's like spirit facts. It's like you're casting a line into the invisible, and you can feel a tug. So that's an experimental thing. And so Jupiter says, you know, whatever you've gotten all the good out of, you go, you know, tragic romantic nihilism and suffocating depression, I think I've gotten all the good out of that, you know. And see, in Jupiter's world, you don't really need to analyze it. You just need to put it on the curb so that the Jupiter kind of Pluto removal service can take it away. I mean, you can rummage through it overnight like a raccoon if you want, you know, but it makes it harder for Jupiter to take all of it away, you know. So Jupiter says, that's good. And then on a different day, same process, but with a different intention. Jupiter says, you know, what do you want to feel like? You know, in 6 months' time, Jupiter likes a little lead time, so Jupiter can be your booking travel agent to arrange circumstances that produce that feeling. So again, it's a way of navigating around our own limitations and expanding our possibilities. Often we don't know exactly what we want, but we all pretty much know what we want to feel like. Adored, on track, you know, giving our gift to the world, doing meaningful work, that kind of quality. And then each person has a flavored nuance that they want to add to that, which is completely invited. And Jupiter, also being a big planet, great Harlem minister Rev Ike says, you can go to the ocean with a thimble or a bucket, but the ocean thinks you're pretty silly if you say, please, ocean, can I have a thimble full of water? So Jupiter's the part of us that likes big, expansive, overreaching plans. And, you know, the more timid parts of ourselves are like, I really want to do this big thing, but I should start small and do a little warm-up. You know, and what happens then is that we screw up, and then the negative, difficult reality police parts of ourselves say, see, you couldn't even do that little thing. How dare you dream large? But the irony is that when we do a big thing that we're not sure we can pull off, we engage Jupiter, this kind of magnanimous, path-opening generosity, and our own passionate enthusiasm is engaged, and we do better than if we're just doing some preparatory thing that we're not really interested in. It's just a warm-up. Jupiter says, telling the story attracts the molecules of its manifestation. And that leads us into our next Jupiter theme, which is the redemptive power of theater, and how it is incumbent upon each one of us to reclaim this in our personal and also our collective social lives. And a great playwright buddy of mine, Julia Steiny, has been a wonderful mentor, and she says, you know, the problem with 20th century creativity is that it doesn't understand dramatic act structures in a play, which, if you track the history of theater, were always meant to be organic. And one way to think about it is that, she says, the five-act structure is intrinsically comedic, which does not necessarily mean ha-ha, it means resolution. And so what she gives to us, she says, yeah, here's a little, you know, kind of one-minute history of drama. You go, act one is context. Here we all are. Act two is away, the journey. Act three is oops, whoa. Act four is evil, where the blocking characters appear to win. And act five is the kiss, the wedding, the redemption. In the mass, it's the sending forth, go forth and do good in the world. It's that resolution to, you know, let it go this way, oh, you know, oh divine, please let it go this way. Or, in fact, a resolution. You know, Shakespeare ended almost all of his comedies, the mature work at the end of his life, if he was one person, we don't know for sure, but anyway, with at least two weddings. And so the model is that in the modern world, the power of storytelling, you know, is crucial. It is our assignment. How do we tell the story of how it can all turn out okay without all of us having to die and without tremendous, you know, damage to our spirits by thinking in triage terms, you know, World Bank MBA terms. Well, economically, we just got to write off Africa. Well, economically, we just got to write off these species and these animals. There's some part of us that just completely bucks and whinnies and is unwilling to go along with that. And the gods go, yeah, you know, don't believe in realism. You know, realism is just depression masquerading as realism. And we have larger forces of cooperation available to us. So what a friend and I say in our discussions is, you know, that a lot of modern creativity is like grimy reality back in your face, Act 4. You know, it's like here, you know, oppression plays. You know, life sucks, here you go. And it's like, oh, I feel very refreshed by that evening out, you know. And what my playwright friend says is she feels like standing up in movies and theaters going to the author, you come back here and write the fifth act. You know, it is your job. Also, we know in modern creativity, a lot of things, you know, kind of are great three-fifths of the way through, and then the whole thing collapses, and you go, no structure, no sense of vision, no sense of the sacred responsibility of storytelling. Hollywood will sometimes cheat and tack on a happy ending without doing Act 4. You have to earn Act 5, the resolution, by really dealing with the blocking characters. Now, why this is so important to us all is, again, we'd collectively say, human culture is at Act 4, you know, where it appears that the forces of greed are apparently winning. How do we all participate in writing Act 5? I'd never understood until recently why Jupiter would say travel, storytelling, ritual, theater, and games. It's like, well, games are kind of theater, it's interesting. But it's very interesting, again, the more you sort of look at the modern world, modern educators, education being a Jupiter field, incredibly discouraged at children under adversity. The statistics are so grim. I mean, the chances of a child born into poverty or into an alcoholic family of becoming an alcoholic are incredibly high. But educators decided to study those rare, exceptional children who were making it under incredible odds and duress. It's called the Resilient Child Movement. And what they found was that in every child studied who was traveling into expanded horizons from extreme limitation, again, these are all Jupiter themes, travel, expansion, broadening, there was someone in that child's life, an aunt, a neighbor, who was teaching the child a game. And it didn't seem to matter what the game was, chess, baseball, anything. I mean, it might matter what the game is, but it was sufficient. Now, on one level, we'd say, well, at the very least, in that child's life, there was somebody beaming at that child, I like you, you know. But it was also the game, it was so interesting, again, the game allowed somebody to travel beyond the narrow, you know, boundaries and to take off. Games are a culture's primary delivery service of its teaching. You know, and where are we in the modern world? We think of games like art, sort of frou-frou, just stick the kids in the corner with a game. What the game is seems to be really crucial, because that's the imprint of possibility, of whether it's expansion. And when we look at mainstream culture with its games, you know, video games, what are the teachings there? The price of failure is death, kill dispassionately, and the kind of welding of the nervous system, you know, to a kind of computer machination, a kind of, you know, more robotized sense of things, at exactly the same time when in traditional cultures, children would be learning complex weaving techniques. The development of the brain and its complexity is happening right around then. And games are the guidance and the development. Again, a way that this was brought home to me was I had two completely separate conversations, one with a Maori elder friend of mine in New Zealand, who was a great healer, and another with a Native American friend of mine here, 6 months apart, thousands of miles apart. Both of them said to me exactly the same thing. They said, you know Cat's Cradle, the children's string game? And I was like, yeah. They said, that's how our elders teach children how to enter the dream world. I was like, oh, that's really cool. How interesting, you know, that these games all had meaning. And again, it makes sense if we know string games. It's, again, a kind of mesmeric complexity that helps to train and cultivate the brain with infinite resources of adaptive response. And that's what games are really for. And that's why these resilient children could travel outside of incredible hardship and duress, because they had tremendous adaptive resources of response. And so, you know, all of us who have an affinity for games and play, it says play is really serious, you know. I mean, play is really crucial if we're going to dream again the world into being, a world that we all want to live in.